Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 5th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We're happy to welcome to today's call our expert, Mr. Todd F. Bronstein. He is counsel at the Wilmer Hale Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to give us some background on the Yates case and then tell us about the implications and the argument. So with that, Mr. Bronstein, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean. Yates versus United States is a case that has come to symbolize a concern shared by a growing number of Americans about over-criminalization. One aspect of over-criminalization is the concern that Congress is drafting very broadly worded statutes that criminalize a lot of conduct that previously would have been punished civilly or not at all. Another aspect of over-criminalization, which is present in this case in spades, is that the government is taking these broad statutes and pursuing cases that really have no business being charged at all. So in this case, the government took an obstruction of justice statute that was passed as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley law and used it to prosecute a man who had thrown some fish into the Gulf of Mexico. So here's some factual background about the case. Yates was a commercial fisherman who captained a ship called the Miss Katy, which is a vessel that harvested fish in the Gulf of Mexico. In August of 2007, there was a routine inspection by a deputized federal officer who noticed several red grouper that appeared to be smaller than federal regulations. He measured the fish, and he determined that Yates had illegally harvested 72 undersized red grouper. So the officer placed these undersized fish in a wooden crate and told Yates to leave them there and bring them back to the port for investigation by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Yates, once the officer had left, directed one of his fellow crew members to throw the fish overboard and replace them with other red grouper that were larger. When Yates and his crew went to the port, the anomaly was discovered, and the crew member eventually confessed under questioning by federal agents. And as a result, Yates was prosecuted for several obstruction of justice crimes. One of the laws he was charged with was the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which is known as Section 1519. And this crime penalizes any effort to destroy or tamper with, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, unquote, with intent to obstruct a pending or contemplated federal inquiry. So in this case, the tangible object was the red grouper. The jury convicted Yates, and he has appealed to the Supreme Court, which held argument this morning. Yates' argument was that the phrase tangible object does not mean every single tangible object under the sun. He said that the phrase is really chameleon-like, and draws its meaning and limitations from the context. So in this case, when Congress criminalized efforts to destroy, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, it intended to restrict tangible objects only to things that are used to preserve information, such as computers and servers and similar storage devices. Yates relied heavily on the statutory canon of construction known as justem generis, which says that where a general word follows a series of specific words, the general is construed to encompass only those objects that are part of the narrower list. But Yates argued that his reading also makes sense given the context in which the law was passed. Everyone agrees that Sarbanes-Oxley was prompted by the Enron scandal, and that Section 1519 in particular was prompted by the mass destruction of documents by Enron's accountants at Arthur Andersen, as well as the difficulties prosecuting Arthur Andersen for that destruction of documents. And indeed, the legislative history of 1519 is replete with references to this statute as an anti-shredding provision. Yates also made a textual point about Congress's enumeration of the prohibited activities, that is, the things that you're forbidden from doing to the records, documents, and tangible objects. One of those things you're prevented from doing is to, quote, make a false entry in the record, document, or tangible object. As Yates pointed out, one can make a false entry in a storage device, but one cannot make a false entry in a fish. Last but not least, Yates argued that reading the term tangible objects to include all physical objects would create a really incredibly sweeping statute. There are hundreds of thousands of regulations, and the broad reading that the government proposed would criminalize the destruction of anything in relation to or in contemplation of enforcement of any of them. And Yates argued that Congress could not have meant to have passed such a sweeping statute in a provision of Sarbanes-Oxley of all laws, that it was more targeted at white-collar crime and the like. The government, for its part, argued that when Congress used the phrase any tangible object, it used a deliberately broad phrase to create a general obstruction of justice statute. And the ordinary dictionary meaning of tangible object is all physical items. And so long as the meaning is plain and the context of the obstruction of justice chapter in the federal code is clear, that's the end of the analysis, according to the government. The government acknowledged that Section 1519 was passed in response to the Anderson shredding scandal, but sketched an alternate history in which the law was really the culmination of a four-decade-long effort to pass a general evidence destruction statute. And they went through, beginning with the Model Penal Code in 1962, a federal commission in the 70s, a number of failed bills in the 80s, and argued that really the Anderson shredding scandal was just the impetus that got this statute over the finish line. The government also pointed to other provisions in the federal code that use similar language that's been interpreted broadly. For instance, one section in the obstruction of justice chapter, section 1512, uses the phrase record, document, or other object nearly half a dozen times. That phrase, record, document, or other object, has been universally construed to cover all physical objects, and the government argued that other object and tangible object are materially indistinguishable. And the government pointed out that Yates's construction would create some anomalies. A murderer could be prosecuted for destroying a letter that the victim sent to him, but not for disposing of the murder weapon or the getaway car. The government argued that the making false entry point shouldn't carry weight because the court has never held that every verb has to match up with every object. Congress drafts these statutes broadly and doesn't mean for everything to match up syntactically. So at the court today, my reaction was that the government appeared to have won on points in the sense of getting a better reaction from the justices to their legal arguments. At the same time, there were a number of justices expressed palpable discomfort with the breadth of the government's interpretation, and this contingent of justices will clearly be searching for a limiting construction of the statute if they can find one. I think Justice Alito summed it up best when he told the government that you've got arguments here, but you're asking the court to swallow something that's really pretty hard to swallow. So beginning with the Yates' counsel, he got a lot of questions challenging his legal analysis. Justices Kagan and Ginsburg wondered how a tangible object in Section 1519 could be different from other object in Section 1512. Justice Alito criticized Yates' interpretation for making the phrase tangible object essentially surplus. And Justice Kennedy highlighted the anomaly pointed out by the government using the hypothetical of someone who took a picture of someone throwing the fish overboard. If you were to destroy the fish, that wouldn't be covered by the statute, but if you were to destroy the picture, it would under Yates' interpretation. By far, the most vocal skeptic of Yates' position was Justice Kagan. At various points, she really took up his cause took up the government's cause and articulated a lot of those arguments. She minimized the verb-object mismatch. She highlighted the similarities between Section 1519 and 1512. And she basically waved aside the overcriminalization point by saying, well, you know, Congress passes broad statutes that criminalize lots of trivial things. That's just what Congress does. By contrast, when the government got up to argue, rather than challenge to its legal analysis, all of the energy was behind the questions about policy and prosecutorial discretion. Justice Scalia, in particular, was deeply troubled about both the breadth of the statute and especially the 20-year maximum penalty that it provides. He wondered aloud what type of prosecutor brings this type of case, and he joked that it must be The same guy in Bond versus United States, which was the case last term, where prosecutors used a chemical weapons statute to address a petty revenge scheme. At one point, Justice Ginsburg asked whether the Justice Department provides any guidance on how to navigate between overlapping statutes, including overlapping obstruction of justice statutes. The government's lawyer commented that once the decision is made to prosecute, the Justice Department's policy is that you should bring the most severe charge that you can that can be sustained. And this position clearly troubled several justices. Justice Scalia, upon hearing that comment, said that in light of that policy, he was going to have to be very careful about how broadly he construed criminal statutes, how severe he made them. And several other justices referred back to this policy throughout the argument. Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, Alito, and Breyer all made comments that indicated that they were troubled by this particular policy. Justice Kennedy, who's always a swing vote, even went so far as to say that in light of the policy, he didn't think he should use or refer to the concept of prosecutorial discretion at all. The government acknowledged these concerns about the breadth of the statute, but suggested that the justices' concerns about this statute have to do more with other aspects of the law that are unrelated to the construction of tangible object as encompassing grouper. In particular, they pointed to the fact that the statute covers any matter within the jurisdiction of the federal government, and the fact that a proceeding need not be pending at the time, as those are being the reasons why the statute is particularly broad. And they said that those are issues that should be addressed another day. aside from the overcriminalization point, the justices didn't really seem to latch on to the key arguments that Yates was making. None of them referred to it as the anti-shredding statute, despite the very prominent use of that phrase throughout Yates's brief. None of them highlighted the verb-object mismatch, the make a false entry, use of the term make false entry, even though that was the point that Yates's lawyers emphasized. And Chief Justice Roberts was alone in emphasizing Yates's strongest point, which was that tangible object is adjacent in the statute to the phrase records or documents. So in the end, it appears that the key factor, based solely on oral argument, the key factor will be the weight the justices give to the overbreadth point. One ordinarily thinks of the breadth of statutes as being Congress's domain, with the court stepping in when there are other issues of constitutional dimension at stake, like federalism, as in last term's case on the chemical weapons statute. And those issues of constitutional dimension really aren't in play here, or at least the justices didn't emphasize them a great deal. Instead, the disagreement appears to be at the level of policy, and for that reason, I think that the government will get more votes than I would have thought going in, and they even have a fighting chance of pulling out a victory here, which is not what I would have suspected. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one question, and then our phones are wide open. Let's go to our first caller.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. This is Corey Andrews with Washington Legal Foundation. We filed an amicus brief in the case. And I was wondering if you could comment on Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer seemed very interested in a void for vagueness argument relating to the overbreadth of the statute. In particular, he seemed concerned that it encouraged arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. And then there was some discussion about whether this issue had been waived or not. And what I thought was interesting was that I went back to look at the question presented that the court granted cert in, and it wasn't a statutory construction question. It was whether the statute provided fair notice or fair warning to Mr. Yates that his conduct was criminal. I wonder if you could comment.
Sure. Yes. Justice Breyer emphasized this point at great length and presented a number of hypotheticals that Yates' counsel had trouble really struggled with. Justice Breyer's point is that this statute is so broad and so sweeping that it really doesn't provide any. It basically allows prosecutors to do whatever they want and pick out almost any activity or a wide swath of activities for charging. He uses the hypothetical of, the EPA submits a survey door to door, under somebody's door, and they really want people to fill it out, and somebody says, I'm not going to fill this out, and throws it out, and says, I'm going to show it to that'll prove it to the EPA. They're not going to bother me, and he wondered whether or not that type of destruction of evidence was really his concern was that this was way too broad. Yates's counsel, after sort of grappling with this for a little bit, Justice Breyer basically said, how can we write an opinion to address that concern? And Yates's counsel suggested that rather than just limiting the definition of tangible object to records and documents or information storage devices, that they could limit it to business records, and that would narrow the statute in a way that would be more focused and offer less discretion to the government. You're absolutely right. I noticed as well that the issue presented really is void for vagueness, and really the briefs on both sides didn't really focus on it. Yates did appear to have preserved it, but really it was almost throwaway argument at the end, and there was really virtually no discussion of the issue aside from Justice Breyer. I mean, it seems very clear that Justice Breyer will write separately on the void for vagueness issue, and he will take that position. But none of the other justices really latched onto that, so it's hard to see that that's going to be dispositive.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. While we're waiting to see if others ring in with questions of their own, let me ask you, was there mention of the rule of lenity here or any presumption against a very broad, a particularly broad interpretation of a statute with a criminal sanction?
The rule of lenity really didn't come up at all during oral argument. It was argued by Yates in his brief, the government's response to that is, the rule of lenity only applies when there's an ambiguity, and here there's no ambiguity. The broader idea, though, about
is it your sense that the court accepted that there is no basic ambiguity in the statute?
No, I think that a number of the justices, I think that there are good arguments on both sides on the statutory interpretation point. And, I think that to the extent that the justices find ambiguity, a number of them signal very clearly that they're going to go with a narrowing construction, precisely for the reason you say, because this is a criminal statute, because of the 20-year penalty. The 20-year penalty got a lot of discussion from a number of justices. As I said, my sense was that on points in terms of the strict legal analysis, making the case that the statute says this and means this and the structure and the purpose fit, my sense was that the government had the better of the argument and that was the conclusion the justices came to. And the concern was really more about the implications of that and the justices being concerned about the implications of that. So, I think they will look for, Scalia will look for any excuse he can to adopt the narrowing construction if he can find one.
You seem to be a bit surprised that the government did as well as it did. Is that based on just what you knew about the case, or based on your reading of the briefs, or some combination of that?
It's a combination of those things. I mean, I think this was an issue that the court reached out to accept cert. There was no circuit split. There was no dissent in the 11th Circuit. It's a rule of thumb that the court often doesn't typically take criminal cases in order to affirm. With that kind of context, it seemed as though Yates had the upper hand going in. You read the briefs, and both sides have very strong arguments. I personally thought that Yates made some very powerful and compelling arguments, and I actually thought he had the better of them. But some of the arguments that he really emphasized, you know, the justices didn't seem to latch onto, and that can mean anything. It could mean that you know, oral argument being an imperfect guide to what's going to happen in the opinion. But at least today, they didn't really seem to pepper the government with questions that recited the arguments in Yates's brief, for example.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open if you have a question or a comment for our expert. I want to take you back to something you said earlier while we wait to see if others ring in with questions about the Department of Justice policy, about its pursuit. I don't want to mischaracterize what you've said, but its pursuit of the broadest reading possible, but also the broadest enforcement, and maybe seeking the penalty or the bad behavior that might have been engaged in with the greatest penalty, and that's the policy of the Department of Justice. Is that an accurate statement of what you were discussing earlier?
It certainly was at the time I was a prosecutor, which was not very long ago. And
that seemed to catch, I mean, based on what you said, that seemed to catch Justice Scalia a bit by surprise. And if I heard you correctly, it almost sounded as if he was going to rethink his whole, you know, interpretation and application of the federal criminal code based on the way the Department of Justice is pursuing these cases. Is that correct? Or maybe you could say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's at least what he said. He did seem very taken aback by that, as did others. And yes, the comment that he made is, you know, I'm going to have to think very carefully in the future about how I deal with these types of cases and giving broad sweep to criminal statutes given this policy. And Justice Scalia was not alone in saying this. Justice Kennedy, as I mentioned before, basically said, you know, so really there is no prosecutorial discretion anymore. One thing I will say that got a little bit lost in the oral argument is that it is true that the Justice Department policy, although I think it's been softened somewhat under Attorney General Holder, but it is true that the Justice Department's policy is to, you know, charge the most severe crime that can be sustained. But that's not the same thing as saying there's no prosecutorial discretion, because that's not the same thing as saying we're going to charge everything. It's once the decision is made to prosecute, you are supposed to charge the most severe sustainable crime. But a case like this, or some of the other hypotheticals that were thrown out today in oral argument, you know, really really minor infractions that might technically fall within the scope of this, those are the types of cases that DOJ declines to prosecute all the time because they aren't deemed to be sufficiently serious, or there's not a strong enough federal interest, or what have you. So those considerations are very much in play, and always have been.
Why isn't it a form of prosecutorial discretion for the Attorney General, the highest prosecutor, to decide that as a matter of policy, his entire organization will charge to the max? I mean, that's exercising discretion just in one direction, but uniformly so.
Right.
That doesn't count as prosecutorial discretion in the eyes of the justices, or?
I guess what the justices meant was more that, you know, often when DOJ will come before the court and the justices will say, you know, the construction you're giving us is so broad, how can that possibly be? The answer will be, well, Your Honor, you know, trust us, maybe not trust us, but prosecutorial discretion, they deliberately drafted this more broadly with the idea that the government would pick and choose worthy cases. And the court often accepts that, but seeing that the default appears to be pedal to the metal, we're gonna just charge everything. The justices, it seemed, were not going to be giving so much weight to the idea that they could trust the Justice Department to show restraint. I mean, I think that was sort of the basic concept, is that they were rethinking this idea that DOJ, you know, can be trusted to show restraint in pursuing only worthy cases, as opposed to, you know, a guy throwing three red grouper, you know, into the sea.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask the statement by the government attorney that it's Department of Justice policy to charge the max. That seems to me inconsistent with some recent news reports, as I understood them, that in certain cases, and I think they might have been drug cases, the government was, even without the knowledge of judges in some cases, charging a lower crime in order to avoid, at least according to the press reports, what it saw as maybe egregious sentences in some sorts of some types of drug cases. Does that ring a bell with you? And if that's the case, is that fundamentally inconsistent with what the government attorney was arguing today?
I think that is true. And in the last year or two, Holder has kind of softened this push to the maximum approach, which I think was originally inaugurated, if memory serves, by Attorney General Ashcroft, but Holder has softened it, particularly in drug cases, which do carry mandatory minimums. He's emphasized that he's allowing line prosecutors more discretion than they may have had in the past. I think the policy, and the other thing to note too is that the policy is not a rigid policy of charging the maximum in every case. It's more like a presumption, and there will certainly be exceptions. And the Attorney General, may have carved out some exceptions in the case of certain drug offenses where DOJ is just not going to pursue the evidence because they think the penalty is unjust.
Very good. Well, I'm going to make a final call for questions here. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Otherwise, Mr. Bronstein, let me give you an opportunity to express any final thoughts or wrap up, and then we'll adjourn our call.
Just to say that I think that in the question of law versus policy, with this court, you'd much rather be on the side of law than policy. And the justices were sympathetic to Yates on the policy questions, and it remains to be seen whether that translates into finding for him on the legal questions. I think to the extent that they can do that, they will. But based on the questions that were asked, it's not clear that that will happen.
Well, terrific. I want to thank you very much, Todd Bronstein, for attending oral argument, for joining us here today. To our audience, thanks for dialing in, and thanks for your questions as well. A reminder to check the Federal Society website for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.